Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm very pleased to welcome to the programme today Dr. Ruth Farrugia. Before we discover what Dr. Farrugia's relationship is with her books, I'll just say a few words about her. After being called to the bar in 1984, this year I gather is a great celebration of your 25 years. Dr. Farrugia continued her studies in various European institutions. In 1990, she spent a life-changing stage at Geneva, the United Nations Human Rights Fellowship Programme. In 1994, she obtained her diploma in canonical jurisprudence and marriage law, and in 2003 gained an MPhil from this university with a thesis entitled Effective Enforcement in the Convention of the Rights of the Child. As of 2008, she is also a PhD candidate at UCL in the UK. At the present time, Dr. Farrugia is an advocate for courts of justice and ecclesiastical tribunal, and a senior lecturer here at the University of Malta. Her current research focuses on issues mainly related to state responsibility and children's rights. Welcome, Dr. Farrugia.
Thanks for inviting me.
We said it was a life-changing stage because you said it was one of those occasions when you were in the right place at the right moment.
I know, so fantastic. Great. Doesn't happen that often in life, but I was really lucky. It was setting up the Committee on the Rights of the Child just as I happened to be there. So, yes, definitely in the right place at the right time.
Created your niche.
Well, I'd always been interested, but to actually be there, I felt I had to do more about the topic then.
It was really written that you should be.
Exactly.
On it. Well, turning to books, when I asked you in our original email exchange which books you would like to talk about, you gave a very wide angled view of your reading. So perhaps we could start with the books that, as you put it, got you going as a child. Which were those?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is C.S. Lewis. I grew up with the Narnia Chronicles and the idea of a magical world and children doing extraordinary things in this magical world appealed to me tremendously. And I also have very fond memories of listening to it being read over the radio. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that is. Alice in Wonderland is also one of my biggies, and I'm not ashamed to admit, but I have to admit that I come back to Alice time and again. It's one of those kids' books that isn't a kids' book. Especially the Through the Looking Glass part of it. I find bits, new things every time I read the book. And I love the illustrations. Illustrations are quite important to me, which is why I still love children's books. But I suppose there was Enid Blyton. Everyone in Malta has read Enid Blyton books. Same thing, empowering children to do things that grown-ups do, or that rather to do them better than grown-ups would. I can't remember a time when I didn't read. Probably my first book was called The Runaway Pancake. That takes me back. I was 4 at the time. but having a book there or having something to read is very important to me. When I went on an academic year out at in Brussels many, many years ago, the gravity of the situation of what I'd done hit me in the morning when I was at the breakfast table and all the breakfast, you know, the cereal cartons and the milk were written in French because, you know, as you're sitting, you read, don't you? And automatically it just hit me, oh my God, what have I done? I'm here for 9 months and I can only read in French, so I've got to pull my socks up. Yes, reading's very important.
The books that you've mentioned, the Narnia Chronicles and Alice in Wonderland, both have very very sharp sides to them, really. They are quite difficult for a child to come to terms with at a certain level. Do you think that is a necessary passage that children have to go through, coping with that kind of literature?
I don't necessarily think that they're difficult, because I think children adapt to reading a book on their own terms. So the fact that I've read Alice several times over the years since I was a child means that my insights into what Carol wanted to say have changed with time as well. At that time, I probably read it very much, you know, as a factual, I don't know, she's talking to a caterpillar, so what, big deal. Today, I think of it in different terms. And I think children are much more resilient than we give them credit for.
They must be, really, because when one looks back at some of those books, I can remember feeling terribly sorry for the Dormouse.
Yes, yes.
You know, that he was sort of... And there was an illustration, probably one of the famous illustrations, where the Mad Hatter, perhaps, has sort of actually got his elbow on him.
And, the tenial plates, they're brilliant.
Yes, those yes, ones. Uh-huh. And I always felt very sorry for him. And although, I went back again and again to read it, I was always aware of that, the slight cruelty of it. And flamingos being used as
croquet sticks. I agree, yes. Yes, I don't know, maybe it goes into making people what they grow up to be and making them either vociferous activists for human rights against the oppressed, but I think that's stretching it a little bit.
Well, it could be. And as you moved on, were the classics presented to you at school? Did they interest you at all? I don't know, Dickens or books on that level?
Yes, obviously, at school. And I found most of them very interesting. I've never liked a story that's too long-winded, and I'm not going to specify who I'm talking about. But there came a time, I think, as I grew older, where I realised that I had to read all of Jane Austen, and I remember reading all of Jane Austen, you know, one after the other, and then the Brontes, and, you know, passionately falling in love with Heathcliff through Wuthering Heights. I mean, you know, really... Yes. Past it today, I suppose. But yes, I did. And then discovering people like Tolkien and Lord of the Rings in my teens.
Those were the cult books,
yes.
Really, at that time.
You couldn't not read those. Mm. And then, as I suppose, you know, a little bit older, people like Joyce, although I've never been able to get into Joyce, more like little bits of Joyce, like Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist. But
Ulysses,
no, I'm afraid. My husband's a lover of Joyce, big time, but no, that's a bit too much. But then Henry James and Joseph Conrad, and I've always liked Shakespeare because I love poetry, so the poetry in that. Yes, it did make a difference to the way I looked at the word using having to read classics. And I didn't have to read them, apart from the ones I had to do at school, but the ones I did read led me to others, and I think they gave me a good sounding ground for the sort of books that I would end up having to read in my professional life, which aren't always fun.
No, not exactly readable, the law books, are they?
Oh, no, they're very interesting. Don't say that.
Yes, sorry. Yes.
Not fun stuff.
It's interesting that you should say that some of the books was long-winded. I think sometimes some of the books that we were rather pushed into reading when at a certain stage in our education are actually more fun to hear, and you mentioned before that you liked to hear them on the on the radio, and I think actually Dickens, I've always felt this, that I much prefer to have Dickens read to me than to actually read it myself.
Well, you're a mind reader, because I was thinking of Dickens, exactly.
I thought you might.
I remember having to do, I think, two set books by Dickens at school, and I always found him hard going. Probably you're right. Read out loud, and certainly the message that he's bringing across is extremely valid and worth listening to, but I could never really get into the book and feel, I don't know, feel comfortable in the book, and I have to feel comfortable if I'm going to enjoy it.
We'll have to organise some Dickens readings.
definitely.
And you also mentioned in your wide description of your reading appetites, biographies.
Usually modern day biographies. Sometimes, I think more often than not, people who are still alive with us doing something interesting. I don't know, Aung San Suu Kyi and Shirin Ebadi in Iran, Obama's biography. I found that very insightful, to understand him feeling that he had sort of, you know, one leg in one world and another leg in the other, and trying to put the two together. Yes, I like to read about people who are still with us and facing the world and actually managing to do exciting and interesting things.
Yes, I think the Obama biography actually has touched quite a lot of people who've perhaps gone to it because he was a key figure at the moment, but in actual fact did find somebody, as you say, who had a real sort of existentialist problem and describes how he sorts that out in his mind.
Exactly.
How it manifests itself in his character. I think that was interesting.
I also like reading biographies, if they're around, about books about authors I like to read of. For example, I'm thinking particularly of Iris Murdoch, whom I really like, big time. A film was made about her, Iris, yeah, with Judi Dench. But there have been various biographies about her, the fact that she had Alzheimer's, how a brilliant mind like hers ended up going through such a difficult illness, and the people around her, how they viewed this illness. And I found reading about her made me, I don't know, somehow feel more in touch with her. It's the need to make a connection of sorts, if that's possible at all.
And you went back to her books with a different
yes.
eye?
Yes, I did. Yes, I found it was... Obviously, the earlier books were when she was at the height of her brilliance, her philosophical... I mean, she's such a clever person. Yes, it made me look at her differently.
The great classics are there. They're always there. We know about them. We've been told about them. We know there's a list of must reads. Mm. But the more modern publications, we have to, or have the opportunity at least, perhaps to discover on our own. How did you discover your present reading list, so to speak?
Well, in the early 80s, I discovered the Booker Prize. There, you know, the various prizes for literature, the Booker Prize, the Whitbread, the Orange. Actually, the Whitbread's called the Costa now. I think Costa Coffee's taken it over. Anyway, yes, I discovered the Booker Prize, which I'd never heard of before in my great ignorance, because it had been around a very long time. And they come up with this long list at the beginning of August and a short list at the beginning of September. And I'm subscribed to their list. Anyone can, you know, just Google Booker Prize. And you have a list of these wonderful books of established authors and first-time authors, and you have a time to read them in order to judge them in your head before the official judges get to it first and see whether you've guessed correctly or not. I've discovered some wonderful authors over the years.
Such as?
Ian McEwan. I mean, I discovered him through the Booker. I think he'd written... What had he written? It was still early days there. Comfort of Strangers. That was a very, very long time ago, in the early 80s.
1981.
It's a very interesting book, that. But over the years, I mean, he's had quite a few that have been shortlisted. Not all of them have made it. Saturday and there's so many of them. Atonement, Amsterdam. I just love the way he writes. And if there were an author, if I could ever be an author, which I'm not, I would love to write like him. He chooses the right word at the right time and says everything I want to say.
He's quite dark.
He can be, but very true to life, unfortunately, and so insightful. Doesn't he make you think of... He makes you think of things that you knew, but you'd never really stopped to concentrate on, you know, to spend a little while on. I mean, how anyone can write a whole book about one day in Saturday is beyond me. And when I read the blurb on the back, I thought, come on, you know, not even he can do this, but he can.
Absolutely. And certainly Atonement, of course, has become now world renowned, particularly because of the film now. But it is a dark story. And the protagonist, Bryony, is a difficult person to swallow, I found. I felt like screaming at her on many occasions. I'm sure that's obviously what he wanted us to do, to feel the
frustration.
Yeah. The whole book is about their frustration at not being able to get the truth to come to the fore. And the fact that at the end, she never really makes any apology.
No, that's just the way it is. Mm. And really and truly, it would be... In a way, I think it would be insulting to apologise.
Yes.
Because there's that very British the fact that he, and the gift of understatement, I think, throughout
and
his writing.
Upper lip as well.
All of it's understated, and I can relate to that quite a bit. But I think he got me going, and others. I'm thinking of other people regarding books that deal with the First World War, because that was an area that I'd never thought about before, and so many things happened in the First World War. As a matter of fact, after reading Atonement, I looked up lots of other books on the era. What happened in Canada, people who were interned in Canada, some very interesting books that were written, and Pat Barker's trilogy on, you know, The Eye and the Door, what happened when people were conscientious objectors. They're all modern classics, whatever you want to call them, very interesting books. So I tend to get interested in a subject and then read what people have written about it, which is why I end up this wide range of authors, because it's usually not the author that motivates me, it's the subject matter.
Yes. Well, certainly the First World War is, if frustration is a word that... what sort of interests one as a theme. Anything to do with the First World War, I think, is frustrating at just about every single level that you can possibly think of. Another author that you mentioned was Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And she's somebody who I'm particularly attracted to. I really enjoy her books.
She's lovely, isn't she? Mm. She can write in such different ways, though, mm-hmm. I think. Such different, not styles, but about such very different topics. And I like that versatility in her. Also, I feel I can connect to her when I read her books, except for Oryx and Crake, which is a science fiction book, which I know you'll disagree with me, but I'm not keen on at all. I read the book, but no, not one of my favourites.
I love sci-fi. I think it's a great genre, but anyway, that's
to each his own.
Person. I thought that her Handmaid's Tale, again, was dark. And clearly, what she always says about that particular book, that, you know, don't be shocked because this has all happened already.
Yes, yes. It is, actually, as I was reading it, it's put so matter-of-factly, isn't it? As she's putting it down, you're thinking, you know, she's talking about something that's really terrible in such an obvious sort of way, and I'm supposed to buy into this. And then you stop and think, and yes, it is probably possible. You know, it's not that up in the air. Again, the talent of an author to make something appear so accessible.
Mm.
Wonderful.
That lovely, as you say, that effort at making abnormality seem totally normal. And she really does that beautifully.
Yes, she does. She's very clever. Also, there's a... I don't know if you read Alias Grace. It's a book about... based on a real-life story of a woman who's supposed to have killed someone. And apparently she did one draft where she reviews what happens to her and comes out thinking, you know, she was in the right or she was in the wrong. And then in another version, it's completely different. And again, I can relate with that, because what she's done is assess the situation and had the guts to say, no, it shouldn't have been this way. You know, I want to change my mind. I have different facts now. I think that's wonderful in her.
This is an interesting point coming from a lawyer.
now.
And Ishiguro, again,
yes,
is one of those writers. He's come from one society, I think he was about six when he came to Britain, and who had to act as like a mediator for his parents, who really found British society really hard to comprehend.
Mm.
And so he has this lovely sort of coping in two cultures feel to him, and has written some incredibly well-received books, about six novels, I think.
I find them wonderful. I find his books, there's some sci-fi in those too, I'm just thinking. Never Let Me Go is a very sci-fi one. Yes, I think he manages again to bridge both worlds somehow, and to bring the richness of a culture, of another culture, into England. And the way he matches the two, I read quite a lot of books by people who aren't native English speakers or writers, because I think the way that they talk about their experiences is I find it fascinating, I have to admit. Ishiguro is more than that, though. Ishiguro isn't just telling a story. Ishiguro is making lots of points, and he's making them in a very topical sort of way. Even the choices of the books, of the titles of the books, he'll use "Never Let Me Go" is part of a song, and I think that's wonderful. The fact that he uses these tools that are available to him today, now in this modern context, and yet tells a story that can be talking about something, you know, that happened years and years ago. The mix of the two. I don't know if you know, but I read this interview that was done about Ishiguro, and apparently his parents financed him taking years out to be able to write his books, which I thought was very, very brave and noble of them. Certainly reaped benefits in the end.
Yes, I suppose.
If my son's listening, right, forget it.
Absolutely. His latest book is a collection of short stories, which he refers to as nocturnes. So the idea is, from what I understand, I haven't read it myself, that he has this idea of the musical movements, which are separate but somehow link together. I think it's a beautiful idea, and he was originally a songwriter, so I think this musical theme is obviously part of his makeup.
Well, I do have the book, it's sitting on a bookshelf, but I have to admit that I'm not a short story lover. Very, very few short stories. It takes me, this is my problem probably, it takes me a while to get into a book, which is why I need a longer story. As a matter of fact, it's a nice thick volume that goes into something like 400 or 500 pages. I'm extremely happy.
Doorstoppers are...
That's right. I love those. But I'm willing to give this a try.
Oh, I think it's probably worth it, definitely. These are books which are, yes, enjoyable, but obviously require quite a bit of thought and concentration. In those moments when you've had a long day and you've had some difficult clients, or you've been in the tribunal and you just don't want to hear any more problems, what do you curl up on the sofa with? In the evenings.
Yes, okay, my shameful secret. I read crime. I love the crime novels. Ruth Rendell, Reginald Hill, good old Morse, Colin Dexter, Patricia Cornwell, you name it, I read them. Where there's a long-established character that I can come back to, I so enjoy taking on where I've left off before. I mean, I wait anxiously for a new... Patricia Cornwell to come out, or a new P.D. James to come out. When Dexter killed Morse off, I mean, it was so emotional for me. Absolutely terrible, you know. Yes, I love crime. It's very far removed from anything real to me.
And you're not a criminal lawyer, so it's not your line.
No, although my first thesis was about extradition, and I did work for a while in the criminal registry. But no, not at all. I've come to dislike too many gory details, I have to admit. I used to gloss over them. But I think as I grow older, they become much more real. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depends how you look at it, I'm blessed with a very, very vivid imagination. So when I read stuff like this, it stays in my head for quite a while. And probably that's why I use it, because it pushes out other unpleasant, unsavory things that I've heard or seen during the day.
In fact, I was going to ask what it is about the crime novel per se that you find attractive, and perhaps this is the answer.
Subconsciously, I think it's one of them. They're strong enough to, you know, they're not a pretty tale. They don't require, with all respect, a tremendous amount of effort for me to read them. I'm sure they require a lot of effort to write them, and to you know, construct to craft a novel like that takes a lot of effort. But they don't require a lot of input from my part. If it's a whodunit, I don't even bother to you know, to try and cudgel my brain into figuring out who's done it.
Before I just, the last page.
No, I just go along with the story. No, I never read the last page. I go along with the story, and as I say, I enjoy them most when it's a character I know. And there's always a bit about their personal life, because now that so many women write crime novels, there's more of this emphasis. Yes, and it's far removed from reality. I feel good.
Great stuff. One of the things that interested me when you were talking about the written word, what it means for you, is that you said you liked poetry. I don't know why I should be surprised at that, of course, but it's interesting in these days that they've just created a female poet laureate in Britain and this sort of thing. It's interesting to see perhaps poetry might have a bit of a push from this.
It would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if Duffy manages to get something going there. Yes, that's another of my escape routes, but I have to be in the mood for poetry, and I'm not always in the mood for it, although there's always the right poem for the right time. One of my sons gives me poetry to read. He's into poetry big time. And my husband and I met over a quotation from a poetry book and named our younger son after the poet. So yes, poetry is a very big thing. I think that it manages to encapsulate a feeling, a mood, in a short sentence or a short stanza, and I have great admiration for people who can play with words like that. For example, I love Shakespeare's poetry, probably more than the plays. Yes, poetry through the ages has said something so important and so effective. I mean, it's made people fall in love, it's made people fight, it's made people laugh. Thinking of E.E. Cummings, and so much has been done with poetry. And kids love poetry, and you remember rhyme as well. It creates pictures.
Poetry is very much part of my childhood, so I can really empathise with how you feel about that. Well, Ruth, Dr. Faruja, thank you very, very much for
my
coming
pleasure.
On the programme today.
My guest today was Dr. Ruth Faruja. Do join me again next week, when I shall be speaking to Dunjoj Dalli. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.